Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Culture Lab. I'm Christy Taylor. This is the show where we talk about how science intersects with our cultural creations. We talk about novels, music, TV, film. This week, though, we're going to talk about the moon. If you've ever looked up at the full moon on a clear night or observed all the changes it makes over the course of a month, you are participating in a tradition that stretches back through thousands of years of human history. For many people, this sunlight-illuminated rocky body orbiting our Earth is also the site of a certain amount of spiritual awe, religious or otherwise. On the concrete side, we can thank the moon for the tides, eclipses, and keeping the Earth's rotation, and therefore climate, more stable. The rhythms of animal behavior follow the moon's light. But we can also connect the moon's presence to our sense of time, the reckoning of stretches of time longer than just day and night. And depending on who you ask, the moon may even be how humans started thinking scientifically in the first place. Rebecca Boyle is a science journalist. She wrote about all of these things and more in her new book, Our Moon: How Earth's Celestial Companion Transformed the Planet, Guided Evolution, and Made Us Who We Are. I talked to her last month. Welcome, Rebecca. My first question for you is just, what is your favorite phase of the moon? What's the best?
It actually depends on the time of year for me. My favorite in the summer is the full moon, just because it's so dominant, but it's also lower in the sky. So if you ever notice that the sun and the moon kind of seem to do this double Dutch, like jump rope thing across the sky. So right now in the northern hemisphere going toward spring equinox, the sun is still fairly low and the moon is still fairly high. But in the summer, after summer solstice, it's the opposite. So the moon is really low on the horizon and the sun is right overhead. And I just like that moon, like the full summer moon is just friendly. It's like right there. You can see it in your window and it's still so dominant on the landscape, but it doesn't like overwhelm the way that the winter moon can. And then in the winter, I think I like the crescent moon more. Just because it's so dark early, it's so cold, you know, you don't want to be out very late looking at it. So it's just always kind of right there at sunset, and it makes it a little bit easier and more accessible to see it.
I also love a crescent moon, though I had not considered that maybe I like different things in different seasons. So now I will consider that. So when we talk about the moon of Earth, how singular, how special is it?
It is so singular. It's the only moon like it in the solar system. And as far as we know, the broader galaxy, we've never found a system like this anywhere else. And it's much more like a companion to the Earth than a subordinate, I think. And that's partly because it's so big relative to Earth. I mean, it's 1/4 the width of Earth. And if you think about the moons of Jupiter, for instance, or Saturn, like these are just tiny crumbs compared to their host planet. And they're far away, like they don't really do anything as far as those planets are concerned. They're kind of remnants, you know, from the formation of the solar system. But our moon is different. It was formed differently at a different time in a different way than any other moon we know of. Earth is the only terrestrial planet to have a moon like this. I mean, Venus has no moon. Mercury has no moon. Mars has these two captured asteroid little rocks that are not even round. They're like potato shaped little things.
I was just going to say potato. Yeah.
Yeah. But our moon is like a planet. I mean, it's huge and it is a companion to this world. And it really does shape Earth in ways that are fundamental to our existence.
How did then we get this unique companion? What are the leading theories of how we came to have, you know, this giant globe in the sky right with us?
It's interesting to me that we're not totally sure about this. Like, we think that there was probably, I mean, we have some basic outlines of what we think happened. And this happened after Apollo brought some rocks home. We were able to kind of draw some conclusions about how the moon was made. And we think it happened after a collision with early Earth and a different planet, which we've named Theia, which is the mother of the moon in Greek mythology. And Theia was probably the size of Mars now and is in the same orbit as Earth. And these two planets collided and totally obliterated each other. And somehow, probably very quickly after this collision, we ended up with this paired system of worlds, the moon and the Earth as we know it. I called it Earth 2.0 because Earth 1.0 is totally vaporized in this event. And so is Theia. So Theia is no more and Earth 1.0 is no more. But now we have the Earth and the moon as a system. And the particulars of that are still pretty hotly debated, actually, in planetary science. And one more recent theory that I think is really compelling is that there was this sort of new structure that arose after this collision in which both planets were totally destroyed, vaporized, and like literally like into droplets of rock. And it informed this huge steaming cloud. And the shape of it looked like maybe a bagel, like kind of round but puffy with this central kind of hole. You know, it would have been like a central mass in this system. It looks like a hole if you visualize it. But in that center is where Earth reformed. And somewhere else in that cloud is where the moon formed. And we're still trying to figure out exactly how that happened. I mean, the most recent supercomputer simulations of this process suggest that the moon formed within like 100 years of this process, like 100 in, you know, human numbers, which is kind of unfathomable to me.
That's not even geologic time. That's
right. I mean, it's like a blink, you know. And so, but we don't actually know. And that's partly because it's so unique. There's no other place that we can visualize this. There's no other way we can study this somewhere else and compare our system to others to figure out how it might have happened. But yeah, I think that's one of my favorite theories, I guess, is this structure called a synestia. And it may be unique in our entire solar system.
Speaking of uniqueness, also, we've got a pretty hotly anticipated solar eclipse coming up in April, which is a sun-centric event in many ways, but you can't divorce the moon from this phenomenon. And it's in fact, as you write, a very wild accident that the moon is just kind of the right size in the sky to completely cover the sun, but also, you know, not always completely. And, you know, when it is complete, you still get sort of this corona of the sun completely visible against the dark sky. So how did that happen?
This never fails to blow my mind. I mean, it's an incredible cosmic coincidence that I think is in some ways like a little eerie that the moon and the sun appear to be the same size in the sky. And this happens because while the sun is 400 times bigger than the moon, it's also 400 times more distant. And they're both, you know, a perfect sphere. And so it looks like they kind of line up perfectly. And people throughout time on Earth have ascribed meaning to that. And I still think about that. I mean, you know, it's a very interesting coincidence that these things are the same size in the sky to line up such that the entire sun seems to vanish. And all you see is the sun's atmosphere. And I mean, imagine being someone, you know, in antiquity or before antiquity, before people started figuring out what was happening, and just the fear and uncertainty and beauty and terror of that event. I think it's fascinating to think about how people must have felt. And I felt that. I mean, I saw one in 2017. There was an eclipse across the U.S. a few years ago, and we're going to have the same thing happening here again. And it's sort of crisscrossing in the opposite pattern. But that eclipse was 2 minutes, and I drove with my family to Kentucky. I was living in St. Louis at the time, and it was going to be cloudy where I was. And I was like, I'm not missing this. So we drove like 5 hours, and that turned into a 10-hour trip home because of so much traffic. But it was incredible, and it was sort of terrifying in a way that I had a hard time putting into words. Like, it is really otherworldly, it's really unique, and I don't think it's possible to overstate how bizarre it is to see a total eclipse. And I think we're very lucky to have them right now. In a few tens of millions of years, we won't anymore. Mm-hmm. The moon is moving away from us, and eventually it'll be further away enough that it will no longer eclipse the sun totally. So we're lucky to be here at this time.
I'm going to rattle off a few more facts like that that surprised and even kind of stunned me from reading your book. But on top of what you just said about the moon drifting further away bit by bit, the moon may also be shrinking. The moon smells like gunpowder. The moon is not just this drab gray, but it actually has color to it. Our own oxygen molecules can end up on the moon. The moon may be why we even exist as a species. These were all some very big surprises to me. What were the big surprises or even delights to you in the process of learning more about the moon?
I think the biggest surprise to me was the role that it probably played in evolution, which I think is really intuitive if you stop and think about it for a minute. But I didn't know this until I worked on the book. And I think the research that shows this correlation is so recent too. Like it was very surprising to me to see how clearly this connection can be made. And it has to do with the tide. I mean, the moon creates the tide in the oceans. And that's probably the way that we experience the moon for the most part on Earth, other than it's light. You know, you see it at night when it's full or a crescent, you know. But most people, if they think about the moon at all, other than seeing it, it's through the tide. And that also is sort of, you know, our experience of that is limited. We experience the tide as like, oh, I'm on the beach and I have to move my towel now because the tide's coming in or something, you know. But it's such a fundamental, almost violent process. Like the entire Earth is sloshing around constantly. And so is the moon. And they're both pulling on each other at a mutual center of gravity. And this tug that the moon exerts on us really changes our entire planet. And back in the past, when the moon was closer, it would have been even stronger, this effect. And I started thinking about evolution from that point of view because I found a really cool study on coral growth rings that dated to the Silurian period, which is like 400 million years ago. And these are like tree rings where you can like, you know, date an environment or an age of a coral by looking at growth rings. And it looks like the day was about 20 hours long 400 million years ago because the moon was closer. And so Earth's day was shorter. Our rotation was faster. And I felt like that would have really also had a dramatic effect on the tide. And I wondered about that. And turned out so had a British physicist had wondered the same thing around the same time and published a paper looking at this tidal cycle and how the oceans of Earth at the time would have responded to this gravitational influence. And it would have created these really extreme tide cycles. And it turned out that these high tide cycles were happening at the same time that vertebrates were emerging onto land. And in 2020, a grad student published the first kind of really deep connection among these phenomena, the tide and the vertebrate emergence onto land. And it's almost unmistakable. I mean, like the tide cycles in the Devonian period, this is like 380, 320 million years ago timeframe, is the age of fishes. And fish are the dominant life forms in the oceans. At the same time, Pangaea is starting to form, this famous supercontinent that gives rise to the dinosaurs and kind of, you know, students learn about in school, is starting to kind of close up. So oceans are closing, ocean basins are narrowing, and tides in these basins would have been extreme, like 80 feet of water between high and low tide. So if you're a fish in shallow water and the tide is rushing out at really rapid rate, like you better get out of there or learn how to breathe the air and move across the land. And that's what happened. And I think the influence of the moon on that process has been underappreciated. And I never thought about it before writing this book. And then I kind of dove into the evidence and it looks like pretty clearly that the moon played a big role in that process.
Yeah, in more recent history, the tides are also key to warfare on this planet, right? I mean, D-Day hinged on the tide situation off the coast of Normandy. You start the entire book talking about the Battle of Tarawa, which is an example of actually the moon kind of letting down a military campaign. Talk about that.
Yeah, so this was in the Battle of Tarawa in the Pacific in World War II. The Allies are trying to get closer to mainland Japan and eventually, you know, prepare for an invasion. And they're trying to capture a series of islands. It was the Gilbert Islands. This is now part of the nation of Kiribati. And in November of 1943, the plan was to capture this coral atoll called Tarawa. And it's surrounded by a barrier reef. And the plan was to make a beachhead in about 11 in the morning on a rising high tide. And the tide actually fails. So the Marines, as they're preparing to invade this atoll, their boats get stuck on the reef and they have to get out and wade across 5 feet of water to shore. And Japanese forces trying to maintain control of the island are just shooting. And 3,000 Marines died in this battle. And it was because the tide never came. This is in part because they didn't have good geographical maps at the time. This is before the space age, obviously. You know, we didn't have really good records of tide charts in this part of the world. They were using tide charts from a century earlier, from the age of maritime exploration, or tide charts from like the coast of Chile, like 2,000 miles away. And so they were just off. And what's more, they didn't know, and nobody thought to plan for where the moon was in its orbit. So it was the opposite of a supermoon, mm-hmm. which we hear about now in the context of the moon being closer in its elliptical orbit. It was further away at this point. And so the tide was weaker because the moon is more distant. Its gravitational influence is less. And it was just enough difference to have this, they called it a dodging tide, where the tide did not rise enough to float the boats over the reef. And the battle was so catastrophic that this is one of the things that led to the NOAA Office of Oceanography, because the Allies and the American leadership realized, like, we don't know enough about the ocean. We don't know what's going on here. We need to actually have scientists study this. And that came about after this battle. And to me, it was interesting because my grandfather was there in this battle, and he was not on the invasion that day. He was on a different island. He was not bombardier because he wasn't in the planes, but he equipped the airplanes with bombs. He was a Marine and he was involved in this battle. And I heard about this as a kid, you know, I always heard stories, but like a lot of veterans, he didn't like talking about it. So I didn't get that many details. And I never knew that this influence the moon had, you know, played such a role in how this battle ended up. And he made it out, obviously. He can return home and married my grandmother and had my mom and her siblings. And we would visit him when I was a kid every summer. And I would hear some stories about his service, but not much. And certainly not about this. I never knew the role the moon played in that battle. And to me, it was just a really fascinating and personal window into how the moon influences us in ways that we don't appreciate.
You trace this really extensive arc of how the moon has also touched our culture, starting with it being a timekeeping tool, then an object of worship, and then the foundation of not just modern astronomy, but modern science. And I want you to help me retrace that arc a bit, starting with thousands of years ago, the ways people used pits and stones and other monuments to track the moon. Why did they do this? How did they do this?
So I think the oldest relationship we have with the moon is through our ability to tell time. And probably also people just enjoyed looking at it, as we still do. You know, it's beautiful at night, and especially before the age of civilization, certainly, but even artificial lighting at night, it's so powerful at night. You can't mistake it. You know, you can't miss it. And so I think people just always noticed it and were fond of it, but it didn't take long for early humans to understand that we could use it, and we could use it to mark time. I mean, if you're thinking about the cycle of the sun, it rises and sets every day. And over the course of the year, you can tell it's in a different location in the sky. We have the solstices where it seems to go back the other direction. But on the timescales that we live our lives, the moon is way more useful. It changes every night and every morning. And so if you're trying to plan something, or you're going to meet someone somewhere, you can say, I will meet you at this tree when the moon is half full, you know, or something. And that's a universally understandable and accessible way of marking your days. And so I think every culture on earth used it in this way and figured this out. And over time, that became more complicated, the way that we use the moon to sort of count ahead. I think it's probably the first way that people were able to orient ourselves in time and mentally move into the future, which as far as we know is a really uniquely human thing. I mean, you know, animals can plan and forage and things like that. And, you know, squirrels can gather nuts and things like that. But as far as we know, humans are the only species that can say, you know, in the sixth moon of the year, I will go on vacation or whatever. And I think the moon is really useful for that. And it allowed us to make these mental leaps in terms of, you know, organizing our lives. And so people used earthen monuments and landscape monuments to be able to connect those cycles of the moon to their lives and to be able to tie those to the sun as well. Because, you know, if you use the sun to kind of figure out when it's time for spring and summer, winter and fall, when you're going to harvest, when you're going to sow crops, when you're going to hunt, you need to be able to pay attention to the seasons. But the moon gives you a more precise way of marking time, and you have to align these two lights in the sky. And so ancient cultures across time and across this planet figured out ways to do that. I tried to find the oldest ones, and I think the oldest one that is probably a lunar monument is this field of pits in Scotland. Northeastern Scotland has a lot of lunar monuments, actually. And one of the oldest is probably from about 8,000 BC. So this is 10,000 years ago. And it's a series of pits dug into the ground in this kind of arcing pattern that traces the horizon. And a few landscape architects have studied this. And one of the more popular conjectures is that this was used as a calendar device. So some people would have maybe burned fires in a pit, like maybe each lunar cycle is represented by one of these pits. There are 13 of them, and there can be as many as 13 full moons in a solar year. And so the thought is that these have to do with the moon, and people use them to mark time and to maybe mentally travel forward in time.
And then we have this moment where the moon goes from being a tool to being an object of worship. And then many, many centuries and thousands of years later, the moon became crucial to Copernicus's calculations that, in fact, the Earth revolves around the sun, and not, as many people were sort of stuck thinking, the opposite. Mm-hmm. How was the moon so key to this understanding? And also why, you know, as you write, is it so key to science as a whole?
I think the way that we use the moon as a timekeeper evolves pretty quickly into a more deliberate sort of form of aid. And so a lot of early cultures worship the moon and are really devoted to it and personify it as a god. You know, this happens across culture, and, you know, develop this deep relationship with it. And because of this devotion to it, people start taking really detailed records of where it is relative to the planets and what it's doing and what phase it is, when eclipses are happening. And that creates this compendium of just data that is used by Greek astronomers to make sense of the universe for the first time. And, you know, one of the earliest people to do this is Ptolemy, who writes the Almagest, which is kind of the great magisterial work of antiquity that brings down all of known mathematics at the time. And it is carried through, you know, 1500 years of history to Copernicus. So Copernicus reads it and is like, this is wrong, because Ptolemy has to do some really interesting math to be able to make his system work. So in his system, which is geocentric, so the Earth is at the center of the universe, all the planets and the stars and the sun, the moon go around the Earth. And he works out their orbits with these really complicated circular systems called epicycles. And to Copernicus, studying in grad school, it's not neat enough, and he's bothered by it. He's actually a very devout Catholic priest, and he's like, this is just wrong. I don't like this. I need to fix the math here.
It's messy.
It's messy. And like, God would never have created an imperfect system. So I need to find a better arrangement of circles. This is what he literally writes in the introduction to his own treatise. And he finds out, you know, the truth, that it's actually not a geocentric universe that we live in, but a heliocentric one, in which the sun is at the center of everything and we orbit the sun. And I think the moon is in part responsible for him finding this out because of the way Ptolemy has to account for its orbit. If his math is right, the moon has to get like a lot closer every month than it actually does and move absurdly far away. And that doesn't happen. The apparent change in size is not nearly as much as it would need to be for Ptolemy's math to work out. But I also think it's interesting that the moon is one of the reasons why we held on so long to the idea of geocentrism, because the moon orbits the Earth. It so obviously does. And you can tell if you just watch it for a few nights. The sun is what lights it, but it's going around our planet and it, you can feel it. And so why wouldn't everything else be? It's logical. You know, I don't blame people for thinking that that's what happened because it makes a lot of sense. And the moon is kind of the confusing element in our cosmology until Copernicus figures out the truth.
And then after thousands of years of staring up at the moon, of the moon being, you know, an object of devotion and of being data, we actually went there. You know, human beings walked on the moon, they picked up rocks, they brought them back. A few representatives of our species have touched that very distant globe in the sky. You seem to have a lot of love and awe of your experience writing this book, but especially that moment when you got to be in the same room as these lunar rock samples that the Apollo mission had brought back. What was that like? And what importance do those rocks have, you know, both as symbols, but also, again, as data?
I don't think there's a way to overstate how important they are. And I think it's in part because we've learned so much about the moon's geologic history and Earth's history from studying them and looking at their components and how they were made and what that says about how the moon was made. But they're also so transformatively different to me. It was so bizarre and almost like spiritual to see them. Like, it's so otherworldly. They're so obviously not from here. They don't look anything like Earth rocks. I mean, every rock here is molded by this planet, by time and wind and water and the tide, you know, the movement of continents over the Earth, planets' tectonic cycles. And you can tell they're like beaten down, where Earth rocks have this like weariness about them, this softness to them. And moon rocks do not. They're sharp and jagged and blocky, and they're crystalline. They look, you know, rough edged, because they are. There's no erosion on the moon to beat them down like there is here. And so that's the first thing you notice, is like they look really different from anything you've ever seen on Earth. And the way they're treated by the curators is almost like reverence. You know, they're protected in these glove boxes and pressurized air. Samples that are not being worked with are stored in a vault that's like a bank vault. And the door actually came from the Federal Reserve. So it's imagine this giant wheel, you know, you're spinning a wheel like a, you know, in a bank robber heist movie.
I was just about to say that would be a fantastic heist movie right there.
Yeah, exactly. So the whole experience of seeing them and being near them is just very, you know, it's almost like a pilgrimage. And you have to bathe yourself in air to wash away all of your own impurities. You have to put on this bunny suit in pure white, you know, to be able to enter the room. There's a lot of kind of familiar feeling rituals for anyone who's grown up with a tradition of religion like I did. And I feel like it's almost impossible not to feel like the entire thing is very special. And then you see them and they really are. They're really unique. And I don't think anything can substitute for the ability to touch the moon here on Earth.
Speaking of touching the moon, our space reporter was talking to us earlier this year about how this really feels like this year is the year of the moon. There's the eclipse coming up, but also pretty much everyone and their mother is sending landers or has sent landers at this point. Private companies are sending art up there and more controversially have tried to send human remains up there. With all this talk of moon bases, mineral extraction, even just like planting a flag, it's starting to feel really crowded, isn't it?
It feels very crowded. It feels very exciting. It feels kind of troubling. It's sort of all of the above to me. And I think I'm super excited about the energy around getting to the moon. People are really invested in this. And I mean, both like literally and figuratively, there's a lot of money flying into the lunar economy right now. And there's just a lot of excitement and interest about going back and sending people back there, sending robots up there. But I hope that as this happens, that we at least take a moment to consider what we're doing up there and why, what the moon represents to us, and the fact that it doesn't belong to anyone. It doesn't belong to NASA or the US or, you know, Japan or India or China or Russia, any of the spacefaring nations who are trying to get up there. And it doesn't belong to private companies that are trying to get up there for both science and profit-making ventures. And I think we need to be thoughtful about that and understand that it's a part of Earth. It's a part of all of us. It belongs to all of us, which means it belongs to no one. And so we need to be really careful with what we do up there.
And in this journey, we've talked about the moon from, you know, timekeeper to God to scientific fact to question mark resource. It feels like there's still room in a lot of ways for the moon to be a site of awe as well, even among atheists like myself. Many people on this planet just celebrated the Lunar New Year. There are entire calendars like that that still run on the moon. Can awe and, I guess, cultural significance for the moon exist with an extractive, commercialized, multinational moon?
I think that is an open question. And it's one that frankly concerns me, because I do think that if the moon becomes, you know, basically a mining outpost for various countries, there is something lost in its power over us, maybe even physically. I mean, I don't know. That remains to be seen. Mm-hmm. But certainly its power over us emotionally and philosophically, I think, would be diminished or at least changed if it just becomes a place for us to traipse around and start digging. You know, I think there's a way for us to explore the moon that's really exciting and that's really secular in the sense that it's for everyone. It's not limited to one culture or one, you know, experience of the moon. But I think, I don't know exactly how that's going to come to be right now. And I don't think anybody else does either. There's not anyone in charge. There's not really an international agreement about how to do this. I think a useful way to think about it is Antarctica, because we've all kind of agreed as a planet that it's special. We've all agreed that it doesn't belong to any nation, even though a few countries have tried to lay claim to it. There's no battles right now for, you know, supremacy there or for sovereignty. We've all kind of agreed that the Antarctic Treaty is a way that we're going to use as a framework to imagine this landmass, which is austere. It's beautiful. It's very dangerous. It's difficult to get there. There's a lot of parallels with the moon. I think it's a good example for how we can do this thoughtfully. And there's tourism there. There's science there. People go there. People can stay for long periods with training and equipment and preparation. And I think that's how we can treat the moon. It doesn't have to be kind of carved up the way we've carved up this planet with artificial borders and, you know, extractive goals. But I think now is a good time to have this conversation, because this is sort of happening in real time. I mean, there's a lot going on this year, as you said, and I think it's a good time for a reckoning on what we're doing.
We started this conversation talking about the phases of the moon and your favorites. As we talk, the moon is almost full. And I guess regardless of the phase, I'm wondering what you would invite listeners to notice and appreciate about the moon the next time they see it. Again, regardless of phase, but maybe there's some phase-specific instructions as well.
Regardless of phase, think about where it is in the sky when you see it. Is it morning and you're going off to school or work or dropping off your kids? Maybe it's in the morning sky. Is it early evening and you're, you know, walking your dog or something after dinner and it's a crescent? Just paying attention to where it is, depending on what time it is, I think is an interesting way to imagine its orbit and how it goes around this planet and how the sun lights it differently depending on where it's located. And then notice it again the next night and see how much it's changed. And you can sort of feel the becoming. If it's a crescent, you can feel it growing. You can see it getting bigger. One thing I think I want people to think about is that when you see the moon, it's almost always a gibbous moon. That's the most common phase you'll see in your life, because it's usually gibbous in the morning when it's after full, it's waning, and it's gibbous for several days before it's full at night. And so most of the time you're awake, the moon is in that phase, which I think is an interesting way of thinking about our lives. Like, we're always sort of almost, we're always becoming something, we're always changing. And the moon is an interesting way to think about that and how we grow and change on a daily basis.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much, Rebecca.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Culture Lab from New Scientist Podcasts. Rebecca Boyle is a journalist and author of Our Moon, How Earth's Celestial Companion Transformed the Planet, Guided Evolution, and Made Us Who We Are. If you liked this interview, make sure you subscribe to our feed for more like it. Plus, our weekly news podcast and other special treats drop every Friday and Tuesday. Find more of the great journalism from New Scientist on our website at newscientist.com. I'm Christy Taylor. Bye for now.
This podcast is produced by OG Podcasts. Find out more at ogpodcasts.co.uk.
Summer's just around the corner, so give your body the care it deserves with Osea's best-selling Andaria Algae Body Oil. Created by infusing Andaria seaweed in barrels of botanical oils, it leaves skin silky soft and glowing. Plus, it's clinically proven to improve elasticity and deeply moisturize without feeling greasy. It's safe, clean, vegan skincare. Get 10% off your first order at oseamalibu.com with code GLOW, plus free shipping on orders over $60.